From unsolved mysteries to unexplained phenomena, from comedy gold to relationship fails, Amazon Music's got the most ad-free top podcasts. Included with Prime. Download the Amazon Music app today.
We're back with another episode of Not Even D2, the podcast covering the narratives that matter, college sports, and beyond. On today's episode, I feel like we've had a ton of great guests, Ruta, but this is the GOAT. So on today's episode, we have Coach David Hickson. Coach Hickson was the Amherst college coach for 42 seasons on the men's basketball side. He surpassed 800 wins in his career, was the only Division III coach to ever be inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame. And just in that, I feel like that says a lot about Coach Hickson. But, I mean, there's a ton to talk about, bro. I mean, coaching at Amherst for 42 seasons, being the first coach ever, winning two national titles. I mean, we could talk so much amongst each other, but I feel like this was a really good episode, and I have a lot to say, but I'll let you take it away on what you got to say about Coach Hickson.
Definitely a D3 go. I mean, you know, when you bring up Coach Hickson's name, especially anyone that's like, I'd say over the age of like 24, like anyone, like not, I think like maybe not in our generation, like they don't really know the impact that he really had, but anyone like in the old, like 24 and up, like, and any D3 player that you name, it's like, when you name Coach Hickson, they're like, oh nah, he's legit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember we texting Coach Crotty about Coach Hickson. He was like, and he started laughing. He was like, he's a really good guy. But did you tell him that? Did he say that he probably would have won more national championships if I wasn't at Williams? So it's funny, you know, to hear that dynamic too between a former, like a legend at Williams, but also a legend in D3 basketball, and their dynamic between each other. And I think this was a great episode, man. I think just one, hearing all the stories that he had was really dope. Like, it's definitely a longer episode, but it's like us as the people interviewing him, we're also like the listeners at the same side of it. It was like we were just listening to him, and he was like, oh, let me know if I'm going on a tangent. We were like, yo, just rock out, bro. Like, we want to hear, like, we not many people get the time to like sit down and really hear him speak about his career, starting from, you know, just being he committed to Amherst. He started playing there, and he stayed there 41 years as a coach. So hearing how he built that program from the ground up into a national powerhouse, I think is good for any young coach aspiring out there to listen to what he has to say, especially when it comes to like the building relationship side, right? Like, every coach is obviously like different, right, and how they approach their players on the team. But it's like a trend that I've seen is just like that building the relationships is so like crucial, because like at the end of the day, like KJ, like, you know this better than I am. Like, when you're in college, like, you can go through a lot of different things like that can really affect your mental and how you may carry yourself, both just walking around on campus, but also on the court, right? So Coach Hickson was like, he had a saying, kind of weed and feed, he said, weed and feed. So it's like he has to figure out like what each player is going through on his team and like make sure they're okay, right? Because if you have like one bad part or one guy who's like, you know, not in it, it could affect the overall like feeling of the group and overall like temperament of the team. So it was a great episode, man. It was, I had a lot of fun talking to him, bro. I can't say enough about that.
Anybody who's a fan of basketball should definitely like actually take what Coach Hickson is saying. And you can relate a lot of what he's saying to things outside of basketball too. And I'll explain that a little bit more, but I want to talk about Coach Hickson. Like, what, in my opinion, what makes him so, obviously he's a great X and O coach, obviously he built great relationships, but one thing that people don't talk about for someone that's coached as long as Coach Hickson is his ability to adapt. So like, he mentioned this a few times in the episode, but think about how hard it would be for a coach today to not have the internet. Like, that takes away the film aspect. You're not able to scout teams as well. That takes away the recruiting aspect. You're not going to be on Twitter and just being able to have access to all these kids' huddles. It's just a different world. And Coach Hickson, without the internet, was a perfect coach early years in his career, he had success. But what is also impressive is as the internet came alive and became apparent in today's age, usually it takes the older generation like a little bit of time to get used to certain technologies. But Coach Hickson still was on top of his game. And like it's 2013 or a little bit before that, and he's still getting great players like Aaron Toomey because he was such a great recruiter. And that stems from just the groundwork that he took when he was without the internet. So now when the internet is alive, now he's a great coach. And Toomey actually was talking about this in our episode with Coach Toomey. Like, he could have played scholarship basketball, but it was Hickson's recruitment that allowed him to just like feel comfortable, feel like it was a home. And it's really inspiring that he was the first Division III coach to make it into the Hall of Fame, because now that changes the narrative of Division III sports in general. Like, when people are looking at that class of 23 Hall of Fame, like Dirk Nowitzki, Coach Popovich, and then they see David Hickson, they're probably not going to know who that is. But then when you take a deep dive into him, it's going to draw eyes to Division III. It's going to inspire the next generation of coaches. Like, oh yeah, I can make it to high levels of basketball, even if I start at Division III. So Coach Hickson is just, his ability to adapt is something that sets him apart compared to other, like, I really think that coaching 42 seasons is something that, like, it might not ever happen again. At one school, that's something that you're not seeing anymore. So, I mean, like I said, Coach Hickson's truly a legend.
100%, and you touched on it. Like, it's like in this day and age, like, we'll see, you know, we talk about players moving up and trying to go to a higher level, but it's like coaches are the same way, bro. Like, coaches like are the same way. Like, they want to build their resume at one school and then keep moving up until they get, you know, probably one of those, like, you know, high major blue blood schools, you know. But sometimes even that's not enough for some coaches, you know. But we see that in coaching too, like, especially now with the uncertainty after COVID and NIL and whatnot. And, you know, like you said, the internet today with, you know, kids that are growing up. But just thinking about how Coach Hickson stayed, like you said, at 41 years at one school, built that program in his image, you know what I'm saying, and to his liking, and recruited the players that he wanted to bring in. And, you know, they did a lot of winning, bro. They did a lot of winning. I believe like 2 national championships, 7 Final Four appearances. So it's just like he has a lasting legacy, not only at Amherst, but just D3 in general. Like, if you want to be a D3, you know, basketball, you know, savant, or if you want to be interested in Division III, if you want to even just coach at this level, I think the first person that you got to look up is David Hickson, because you got to see what he built over at Amherst, and you got to really learn from that. I don't know. I'm just saying this as, you know, I know a lot of young coaches out there, bro. I know a lot of people who aspire to be a coach. You know what I'm saying? And for someone that coached 41 years and built the relationships that he made, where players are making 5-minute reels or movies about his time at Amherst and talking about their times with him and memories with him, like, that's unbelievable things that not every coach gets when they retire. So.
Yeah, Coach Hickson, also a great guy. And something that I, like, we didn't really talk to him about off air or on air, but I really respect his ability to be a helping hand as well, or his willingness to be a helping hand, I should say. So, like, he has a ton of people that he's mentoring, even as a retired coach. Like, he's got guys that he probably doesn't even know. They just reach out like, hey, I have this, or I coach this team. Do you mind helping me out? And Coach Hickson's more than willing to just be like, yeah, I'll watch your team play. I'll tell you what I think. I'll give you some advice. And it's no surprise, like, his coaching tree that he's building. We talked a little bit in the episode about this, but, like, Coach Toomey's great coach. Coach Goldsmith at TCNJ is a great coach. Coach Rainiac just made history. Like, there's a ton of coaches that are doing big things in the division and beyond the Division III division, but we're going to focus on Division III, and they're doing big things. And you look at their resume and it's like, oh, no wonder they spent some time at Amherst with Coach Hickson. He has that impact on the people that he talks to. And then it's also like, he was willing to help us. Like, he doesn't know us, and he just hopped on the podcast. Shout out to Coach Toomey for patching us in. But, and then it's like, now he's a network for us and willing to help us out. So, I mean, I got so much respect for Coach Hickson, And we talk about a ton with him, what drove the success at Amherst. I think you guys definitely should stay to hear about who he has, the Amherst 2017 that won a championship versus the Amherst 2013 team. Great answer he gave us. And we talk about what it was like sharing the stage with a historic Hall of Fame class with, like I said, Dwayne Wade, Coach Popovich, Becky Hammon, just a ton of greats that he was able to be inducted with. And I said this in the episode, but I don't look at the tiers any different. I think Coach Hickson, Coach Popovich, same thing. So, I mean, great episode, and let's hear from Coach Hickson. All right, we're here with the one and only Coach Hickson. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, thank you. Very good. And I'm delighted to be here with you guys.
You're delighted, Coach. I think we are delighted to have you, Coach. It's truly an honor to have you on.
Perfect. So you and I were texting, and you mentioned that every morning you're golfing from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. So just talk to me about like how the golf swing felt today and where you fell in love with golfing as well.
Yeah, you know, today was a beautiful day out there. That was the best part of it. The golf wasn't quite as good, but it's up and down the way golf is. Anybody that plays golf knows it's inconsistent. You can see Nelly Korda wins six straight tournaments, and then she misses two straight cuts. And so not to put myself with Nelly Korda, but that's how inconsistent the game can come at you. And but we really enjoy it. We get out every morning, and we got a group of guys that we play with. My wife's the only woman in the group, but we play. There's about eight of us, and every morning we get out and play. And you know, it's just great fun and great camaraderie out there. And in the end, I don't think anybody really knows who won. We all won. So it's good. It's a wonderful thing to get out. And it's beautiful temperatures that time of the morning and this time of the year. So I
asked you this off air, but I definitely think you got to say this on air. But do you golf with any of your former players? And if so, are they getting kind of competitive with you or no? Are you taking the crown with that?
No, you know, we used to once a year, and we're still trying to do it. We get a bunch of my former assistants and I together, and we play this little tournament, and it's always great fun. Again, the camaraderie and the friendship is the most important thing, but the golf is fun. And, you know, guys like Matt Goldsmith, who's at College of New Jersey, Aaron Toomey's a very good golfer. All these young guys just hit the tar out of the ball, and so it takes me a little while to catch up. Kevin Hopkins plays golf. Mike Rainiac, who's with D3 in the TBT. We are D3. The coach there, he's an avid golfer, and a couple of my other assistants. So, yeah, you know, we again, whenever we can get together, golf is a wonderful game to continue friendships and relationships because you spend so much time together. You think about it, it's four and a half hours. And there's a lot of joking and betting and needling and trying to get in each other's head that goes on. And it's just great fun, but gives you great time to catch up with each other too.
So another little thing I'm curious about. So you've been retired for about 3 or 4 years now, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm just curious, like, I know you said you've been golfing, but do you still like tune into either Amherst games or like Nest basketball games, D3 basketball in general? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I watch regular college games on the TV games, of course, the Division I and the NBA. Mm-hmm. And I've got a bunch of guys in the NBA, not players, but people that are either coaching or GM type people. So I watch a lot of that. But I probably watch the most Division III. And I haven't missed an Amherst game since I've left. I watch Aaron's team play. I actually got a chance to watch them in person last year. I watched Kevin Hopkins' team play. I watched Matt Goldsmith's team play. I watched Luke Flacurzi, who was a former assistant of mine up at Rochester. I watched his teams play. And then I've had a couple coaches who have written me and we've talked, and I've sort of adopted them, and I try to watch theirs. They want my opinion on it. And that's fun. And so I've got to meet some people that way too. So we joke a lot because my wife says she thinks I'm watching more Division III basketball now than I ever have. But, you know, when I'm not watching Amherst, I'm trying to watch somebody else in the league. when there's somebody that's been number one, two, or three, or some of the high ranked teams, I try to get a chance to see all them before the tournament starts. And I really enjoy it.
You're retired now. And a lot of people, when they retire from their profession, they talk about like finding another passion or something like that. Do you feel like you had to get adjusted to being sidelined or like not being involved with Amherst? Like, how did you kind of deal with the retirement process early on?
Yeah, you know, COVID was bad for everybody, but in this respect, it was good for me. I didn't know if I was going to retire, quite frankly. I took a year off to take care of my dad. I took a sabbatical year, and he passed away, and I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. And so I decided, when I took that interim year when I was taking care of my dad, then all of a sudden COVID happened. And I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do during COVID with the guys? And it was so disruptive for everybody. And I was right at the age where I could have stayed or gone for another year or two. That's all. I wouldn't have stayed more than a couple of years. And it just made it easy. It made it perfect that it was the right time. And so I think it's the only good thing that COVID ever did, except for the guys that it gave fifth and sixth years to. Those guys, man, I'm glad they finally done. But the you know, it made it easy. It made an easier decision for what would have been hard. And, you know, my passions, I still watch a lot. I'm still involved a bit. I help out with a group down in Florida that I'm at now, a group that is using basketball as their method to keep kids in school from a really disadvantaged community. Wonderful, wonderful thing down there. And I'm doing a little bit of that. And then I'm golfing and hanging out, and my wife and I are spending a lot. If you can imagine two winter sport coaches, right? Like, we'd see each other in November and say, hey, see you in April. You know, that was about it. And so it was, you know, we did the best we could, and it was great. And we raised two kids doing it. And or I should say, she raised two kids doing it more than I did, but, it's all good. It's all worked out great.
I have a lot of respect for that, especially the Florida group you talked about. I feel like we should go back to that in a second. But first, I want to start with, you mentioned your father. He was also a legendary coach. You guys were both inducted into the New England Hall of Fame. You went to high school at Andover High School, and you were coached by him. And in 1970, you guys won a state championship together. Right. So good for you guys. But I want to talk about, you committed to Amherst right out of high school. What were you kind of expecting as an 18-year-old student going to Amherst? What was your goals for what the next few years were going to be and where you thought your career was going to go after that?
Yeah, you know, recruiting was really different back then. So think about it, with no internet, all right? And it's hard for you guys to imagine. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you didn't hear of 90% of the colleges in the country, maybe 95%, maybe 98% of the colleges. In other words, you know, you didn't hear about the schools. So I'd never heard of Williams College, right? Dartmouth was recruiting me heavily for football. UMass recruited me heavily for track. Brown, basketball and track. You know, so I had a bunch of different schools recruiting me for different things. I wanted to play three sports. One of the reasons I chose Amherst was that I felt that I could play three sports. Dartmouth would have just been football, and I didn't want to do that. And then, strangely enough, I had a really bad concussion going into my freshman year, and they wouldn't let me play football. And then I stopped even thinking about it after that. But, you know, I really wanted to play three sports. I wanted to get a great education. I had a chance to go to Bentley College on a scholarship, but it would have just been basketball. And I loved a top-notch education with the opportunity. I'd always played three sports. I wanted to play three sports. And Division III back then, doesn't so much now, but back then it allowed you to do that. Almost everybody. There were so many guys that I hung out with that played three sports. It was great.
So if I'm not mistaken, Coach, you got hired at Amherst when you were 24 years old. And I just want to hear just like your thought process when you were offered the job and when you took it. And when you took the job, what were some of your next steps in building the great program that you did build?
Well, I'm going to take you one step back from that, because I wasn't going to apply for the job. I was I graduated, and then I was a Hitchcock Fellow, which is they give it to one graduating senior, and that person gets to stay on as a full faculty member, teaching and coaching. And so I did that because that's what I thought I wanted to do. At the time, I had just been practice teaching at a local high school. I thought I'd be a high school teacher and a coach. And so I was, I stayed on. I coached football, I coached basketball, I coached track. And at the end of the year, when the job opened up, I was not going to apply for it. And I thought I was too young. Didn't think I had the resume or the credentials. It just seemed out of my league. And so I thought I'd just, you know, pay my dues a bit more. And so, but one of the guys in the department came to me, a guy who ended up being the AD at Swarthmore, Bob Williams, a wonderful man. He came to me and he said, apply. If for no other reason you apply, you get the experience of going through the interview process. And so I did, and they brought seven people in, including me. And it was great. It was a great experience, and I thanked Amherst for that. And then when we finished, I thought, well, that's probably the end of that. Well, I got called in for the final three. Now, all of a sudden, I'm going like, hey, one thing to get an interview experience. That was nice of you. But now I'm in, don't jerk me around either. Like now I'm in the final three. I'm a competitor. Now, all of a sudden, I got really serious about it. And, you know, it came down to three of us, and they chose me. And it was, you know, I don't even know what to say, humbling to say the least, but it was like, wow, here we go. And all of a sudden it was like, wow, I applied for this, interviewed seven, interviewed three. Now I got it. And now we got it. Now I'm the head coach. Got to figure this thing out. And so again, things were different back then. You didn't have, you were appointed an assistant from within the department. So my first two assistants actually were people that were football coaches and a lacrosse coach. They had basketball experience. I don't want to make them sound like they didn't know what they're talking about, but it wasn't like I had my own staff or anything. And it, you know, everything was smaller time back then. And so we started out, and you know, it was a little bit overwhelming at first. It was you know, I thought I had more answers than I ended. I'm not going to say all the answers, because I didn't think that. I like to think I'm a little humbler than that. But I did think I was going to be a good coach. And, but I got to tell you, the beginning, it was hard. We played some really good teams. Back then we played five upper division teams. My first probably 5 years, we played University of Hartford, played Central Connecticut. We played the AIC against Jimmy Larrañaga. First time, first time I played Jimmy Larrañaga my first year, he ran a score up on me, and we lost by 40. And I'll never forget how upset I was. And but I shook his hand like a gentleman, but I said under my breath, I'm gonna get that son of a gun. Right? Next year, we beat him by six at home.
Let's go.
Turnaround, Jimmy Larrañaga. So, anyway, it was one of those things. We started 0-3 until I got my first win. And then we went to 3-9. And I'm thinking, like, you know, I'm not as good as I thought I was. There was more going by me than I could absorb. And then we get to 9-9. And from there on in, we've been pretty good. So, we sort of figured it out, but not as easy as it looks. And and then, you know, as time went on, and we'll get to that, I'm sure, when we got up into the NCAA era and everything, you began to have true programs where you hired your own assistants and the whole deal. So we'll get to that, I'm sure.
Coach Hickson, that is a perfect transition, because I was actually going to say NESCAC programs, if I'm not mistaken, I read this online, NESCAC programs weren't allowed in the D3 NCAA tournament until 1993.
Right.
So first, my first question relating to this, what kept you going all those years without an opportunity to go to the tournament?
Well, you know, it's funny. A couple of things kept me going, but, you know, we played, the biggest thing on our schedule was the Little Three. Amherst, Williams, Wesleyan, right? And it was a big to do. You know, we got mugs. We got all sorts of stuff when we won the Little Three. That was a big deal. Beating Williams. Williams was the last game of the season because we couldn't play postseason. And so it was a big deal. And so, you know, you stay focused on what you're doing. And again, we were playing all these upper level teams. And so it was really competitive. There was a guy who was a Princeton athletic director who was the basketball coach up at Dartmouth at the time, Gary. And I'll think of Gary's last name, but Gary's a good, great guy. And I was sitting with him. We were playing Dartmouth, and we played Dartmouth for about 5 years. And I was sitting with him before the game. He said, "Well, Dave," he said, "what do you think? What are you thinking of doing?" I said, "Well," I said, "I think, you know, I'm going to start to look at Division I programs." And he looked at me and he said, "Well," he said, "I'd look carefully," he said, "because you and I have two of the greatest jobs in the country right here. Trust me, I know." And so that made a big impression on me. And of course, didn't make as big an impression on him, because the next year he takes the Providence College job, fails for 2 years miserably, and gets run out of town, and became the Princeton AD after that. But those are sort of the things that kept me going. You know, we didn't have an undefeated season, so there were always goals ahead of us. And then we could go to the ECACs finally. And I think it was 1983, we went to the ECACs with a group, a really good group. And maybe it was 81. And so it wasn't long that we could start to play. And it was Division II, Division II, and Division III. So it was really hard to make. And then they opened up the ECAC tournament and eventually became 8 Division III schools. This is all before our NCAA. And so, you know, some of the goals started to crystallize. And when you played in that ECAC championship, like, it was a big deal. Sometimes the ECAC championship was better, had better teams in it than the local NCAA did, because we had the NESCACs. So there were plenty of goals to keep you going as a young coach, I'll tell you.
So this is another perfect transition. So take us back to your first NCAA tournament appearance, right? I couldn't find the year online, but what do you remember about that? And like, how did that first appearance influence the rest of your coaching career?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. So 1993-94, the winter before, the presidents of NESCAC voted not to allow us to go to the NCAAs. And their statement at the end of it was, "And don't ask us again for 5 years." And then something happened, because all of a sudden in the spring, they announced that they're going to do a 3-year trial period, that they're going to let NESCAC schools make the NCAAs and go to the NCAAs when invited, trial period for 3 years. I think the trial's still going on all these years later, but they, anyway, so, you know, we make up a t-shirt, the NCAA, and we're going to do this and do that. So got the guys all excited about it. And lo and behold, us and Colby make it. Colby was really good. And so we got ready to go. We went up there, and there's another thing we're going to talk about later on about, you know, changing X's as always and this and that. Well, one of the great things that happened because of the NCAAs, we went up and had to play Colby up there, and Colby was magnificent. They were really good. Great. They were way ahead of their time with 3-point shooters, and they ran motion, and they brought three guys together at the elbow, and one guy would go to the basket, and one guy would flare out, and one guy would pop out, and nobody could cover it. And that's why they were in the NCAAs, and we had trouble covering it. And we started to switch everything long before people switched. So we put in this switching defense, and we beat them, and we beat them up there. And so now the excitement is that we're actually going to play out of region, that we're going to play somebody that I don't even know the name of the school. You know, I wouldn't have applied there because I didn't know them, right? And guess who it is? It's Franklin and Marshall. Franklin and Marshall going into that game was 26-1. Their only loss was to Princeton. Okay, think about that. That's back in the Pete Carril era. That's when they were off the charts. That's when they should have beaten Georgetown, when they should have upset Georgetown. So Princeton's really good. So Princeton beats them and beats them handily. But other than that, they're undefeated. They're 17-0 at home, and we got to go down there and play. Their coach, Robinson, is going into the Small College Hall of Fame with me this November. And, you know, he had like 500 wins already, and I'm like, you know, this is unbelievable. This is a program. This is what we want to be. Well, I happened to be watching film, and I thought I saw something. And, you know, it's great when you see something. You know, you can watch film, and you get little things here and there, but I thought I saw something. And sure enough, we put a little something in, and we were up at the half. I want to say either 7-9 or 11. I don't remember exactly. And then we got chased out of the gym in the second half because he's a great coach, and he adjusted to it. But we got away with it in the first half, and we got the lead. So here we are in their gym where they're 17-0, okay, 26-1 overall. They've got the crown on their head. Everybody's talking about this big kid. They had a 6'10 kid, Detz, and you know, we had to guard him, and they were really good, and nobody could beat him. And we made, I think, 11 out of 12 free throws to get chased out of the gym, but to win. And it's just an unbelievable experience. And the feeling that I got, other than elation for winning and all this and all that, was that I finally understood that we could play with the country. Like, it's the first time a NESCAC team really had gone out of region and played teams from around the country. And here the best teams are in the country, and maybe the best team in the country, Franklin and Marshall that year. And we beat them. And all the way home, I kept saying to myself, I know where we are now. I know who we are now. And it's not a regional thing anymore. This is a national thing. And we could play with anybody in the country. We just found that out. And, you know, we lost. It's funny because the story goes. So a guy named Flannery was the coach at Pat Flannery was the coach. Later went on to become a very good coach and some huge upsets when he coached Bucknell. But that he took the Bucknell job after winning the national championship the year I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And we had to play them the next night. Mike Rhodes, who coached at VCU, just took some huge job. Mike Rhodes was player of the year in the country that year. Great point guard for them. And no cell phones or anything. I know you guys don't understand that, but no cell phones or anything. Flannery's back at his hotel room scouting, putting together a scout report for who he's going to play, which is Franklin Marshall. Mm-hmm. Right? He left his assistant there to watch the game, right? So his assistant calls him up on a payphone, and he said, "Coach, you're not going to believe this, but Amherst just beat Franklin Marshall." and Pat's going like, "I hope you have some really good stuff on Amherst because I got nothing." Right? And that was the expectation going into the game, that Franklin Marshall was going to be the hurdle. And Franklin Marshall had beaten Lebanon Valley earlier that year. So we lose to Lebanon Valley the next day in a hard-fought game. They went on to win the national championship against NYU in overtime, I think it was. Anyway, it was a great national experience for us. And I came back and told our whole conference, guys, we can play with the country. We can play with the country. And so that, I don't know if I covered your exact question, but that's sort of that's what happened that year, which was just wonderful.
That's definitely very crazy, because you're like the pioneer team, because the NESCAC is now one of the best conferences in the whole country. But you saying, like, before it wasn't, you guys weren't competing nationally, but now it's one of the best nationally. So kudos to you and your staff, your team that year, for starting something special.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, it was an awakening, which was I thought was terrific.
Yeah, but I want to transition into something else. You mentioned briefly X's and O's, and one thing that I noticed sets you apart from other coaches is you have a ton of great sets. There's YouTube clips, YouTube videos on all the great sets Coach Hickson has drawn up or implemented. So I want to talk about how you think you had to change your X's and O's through 1970s to 2020. That's a lot of basketball that you have seen, but the game obviously changed a lot. So what changes do you remember having to implement in Amherst to be successful year after year?
Yeah, so it has changed a lot. So when I first started coach, there was no shot clock. There's no three-point line either, but no shot clock. Now imagine that. Like, I went to scout a game one night, Bates against Keene State. I remember it because it was so unbelievable. It was 2-0 at halftime. You know, Keene State was a Division II team, scholarship team, and Bates was not going to beat them, and so Bates held the ball. They had really good guards, and they held the ball, and it was 2-0 at halftime. And I'm thinking, like, I can't believe I rode my ass all the way up here, you know, to watch this game, and it's 2-0. I got nothing. I mean, I got nothing. But and then we went from shot clock of no shot clock to 45 seconds, 35, and finally 30. Which is much more sensible. The three-point line, you know, the three-point line first came in, and it was unbelievable. You know, the greatest player that I've seen in Division III, I had the chance to be his assistant coach, and I was his captain when he was a sophomore, Jimmy Rehnquist. He was the son of a Supreme Court justice. He, I can't even tell you how many points he would have scored if there was a 3-point line. And as it was, he's our all-time. He was our all-time leading scorer until Aaron came through. But an absolutely unbelievable player. We played Merrimack College, and again, excuse me, 30 seconds here. We played Merrimack College, all Division II. Three guys got drafted from that team, and we go to their place to play them in the ECAC championship. And Rehnquist drops 40. Mm. Okay, now get this: no shot clock, no 3-point line, and we win 97-92. How's that, right?
Wow.
So, yeah, so that's changed a lot, and I do pride myself on the fact that I'm one of the great Steelers. You know, I go out and watch games. I watch film. I watch pros. I watch European sets, and I'll steal something. You know, I'll take it, and then what I'll do is I'll take it and morph it to fit what we do. And we used to do all sorts of stuff like that, and I really enjoyed trying to be as innovative as I could. And again, I some of the stuff was stolen. Another quick story, I went out, I scouted, I saw this great out-of-bounds play I loved. And the problem was that I didn't write it down. So in my head, I'm thinking about it. I put it in backwards.
Mm. If you can imagine
that, I put it in backwards.
That's crazy.
It worked better than forward. It worked. It became a staple with us. It worked better than forward. So, you know, not everything was well thought out. But I really enjoyed that part of the game. It really keeps your mind active, thinking all the time. What can we do better? What can we do better? And defensively, we did some things, mostly switching, that were different than everybody else was doing at the time. We played some zone when I first started. We played some trap when I first started. We didn't do a lot of that later on. We played just good, solid switching man-to-man. But offensively, we did a lot of things.
I have a follow-up on that. I heard you talking on a podcast before, and you were saying, like, in a span of 15 years, your teams were running 4 different offenses. Yeah. So just talk about that process or what you were doing year to year to determine what type of offense you were going to run for that current team.
Yeah. So, you know, recruiting's hard for everybody. So I'm not going to, you know, cry over that. But at Amherst, our academic standards were so high that I couldn't get the kids that I really wanted sometimes. And, you know, we got really good kids and we figured out how to do a better job at it, but there was always kids left on the board. One year I passed 10 names over to admission. They took one out of 10. Right. And so we were always trying to, you had to coach what you got. You tried to get the best you could get, but when the dust settled, you coached what you got. And, I never figured I had this little point guard, 5'7" probably. And he was quick as a whippet. And the 4 kids I had him with, really big kids, they were slow as molasses. And so one of them would get the rebound, that outlet it to him. He'd sprint the floor on the dribble. He'd get up inside the foul line. And if he didn't have a layup, he had to pull it back out. And all of a sudden you'd hear, dump, buddy, dump, 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 dump. And those were the big guys coming. That's how slow they were, right? He had to wait. Thank God there was no shot clock, right? He had to wait for them to get up there before we could set up. So we ran something entirely different with those guys. And then as a 3-pointer came in, we ran different things. And, you know, some years you have a bunch of really good shooters and some year not so much. Some year you have a dominant big kid. And so you're constantly changing the things that you do. Again, I think that's really the intriguing part of doing it all. But it's fun. It's great fun. But our personnel changed, and I couldn't turn around and say, okay, we just graduated 6'10 kid. I want to get a 6'10 kid. I'd go to admission and say, here's a list of 5 6'10 kids. And they'd go, do you have a 6th one? I'd say no. And they said, well, you're not getting a 6'10 kid this year then. So that's recruiting at, you know, strong academic schools. And everybody has that, you know, not everybody gets everybody they want, but for us, there were a lot of other things that were difficult hurdles to get over. So
obviously a ton of the Amherst success should be credited to you and your staff. That's no question, but you also had some fantastic players throughout your career. I read that over 20 of your players throughout your time signed overseas professional contracts, and you coached some D3 greats like Andrew Olsen, who's a 2-time D3 National Player of the Year, and Aaron Toomey, who was a player of the year as well. They both won national championships with you. So just talk to me about how you were able to obtain this great talent year after year to continue Amherst's success.
Yeah, you know, I think it comes from building a program. I think that That's, you know, the baseline of it. And when your kids that are in your program believe in you and what you do for them and how connected you are to them and their families, and the relationships that you build. And when you have kids come to visit, you know, you have a good record, you're a good academic school, so you get a lot of good kids that want to visit. A lot of them looking at Ivies, a lot of them looking at scholarships, but they come in and they talk to the players that are already there and they realize, no, this is cool. I'm going to get a great education. I'm going to have a chance to win a national championship. And I'm going to be playing with some really good guys. And actually the number of players that we've had play overseas is 42. Which is a lot. And the way you recruit it, it didn't start. It wasn't easy. We lost kids early on. Kids in California, you know, the Ivies were so highly thought of, and we were second thought. In other words, no internet, none of that stuff. So you had to find kids that were that you could get interested in Amherst. And but as time went on, and when the internet came available, and all the stuff that you can do with it. It's just really about having a great base of kids that are going to sell the school when somebody comes to school there. And that's what our guys did.
So this is something that you kind of brought up, like building relationships, right? So anytime that we've talked to Coach Toomey, who's obviously played for you, and Coach Reg, who was an assistant coach under you. And I know some, I think he, I'm pretty sure he played under you, Tommy Mobley.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes. So my dad works at Phillips Exeter. He went there, quick story. And I met him when I was, you know, first starting out with basketball. But anytime that we bring your name up to these guys, you could see like their faces like light up and like they're excited to talk about you. Seriously. And like, so talk about why you believed building true relationships with your players would ultimately help you and the program's quest to winning national championships.
Yeah. I mean, I think it starts in the recruiting process because you have kids there that really enjoy playing for you, that believe in all the stuff that you're doing, and they'll sell that to the next generation that's coming through. So that's sort of number one. So you got to have kids there that believe in it. And then it's just a matter of really, when you get kids there, getting those kids then to buy in and believe in what you're doing too. And we used to do this thing that, the expression has sort of gotten around a bit now. I read something by a football coach, and I wish I could give him credit, but I can't remember his name. It was a long time ago. And he was saying that every day before practice, he weeds. Now, I used to call it something different, and it was not a good name. And, you know, it had to do with cancer or something. You know, you have to be able to see, look at the x-rays, you see the dark spots, you figure out what's going on. And so that was a negative. So then I went to this thing, weeding. And so every day I would go out and spend time with all the kids. So I'd get down there 45 minutes before practice, walk around. You could tell by body language who's struggling a little bit. And it may not be with basketball. It might be with classes. It might be with a girlfriend. It might be parents. Maybe somebody's sick in the family. I don't know, whatever it is. But you want to find out. You want to know more about them. You want to let them know that you care about it. And then I wasn't happy with that either because it was pretty negative still. Just everything was a negative. You're weeding, right? And then the guy said, hey, if you let your garden, if you let the weeds build up too much, then you got to break down the whole garden. If you weed a little bit every day, it works, right? So I'm thinking about that. I went down to Home Depot to do something with my lawn. People always laugh at this part of it. And I'm going through and I find this bag of stuff called Weed and Feed. And I thought, that's it right there. It's Weed and Feed. So you can credit Home Depot for that. It's because weed is a little bit negative. You're pulling out the things that are going to hurt the garden in them, but feed. And so sometimes a kid needs to be fed, you know, not just weeded all the time. So I see somebody now, and I could think of a couple of my players that they'd be staring around. And I knew they were down there early because they knew I was going to be down there early. I could tell they wanted to talk, and they wanted to talk to me alone and not with a lot of people around. And we do a little feeding, you know, other kids you have to weed, other kids you feed. And so the weed and feed concept sort of became something that really helped us build those relationships. I listened to Aaron's podcast, and Aaron said how he just felt that I had an open office all the time, and I did, whether it was for alumni, whether it was faculty, whether it was the dean of admission, players. I mean, you know, we had kids in the office all the time that wanted to talk about things, and they didn't always like what they heard, but they knew they were hearing the truth. And they would be given ways to change the situation if they wanted to. So Yeah, I think building those relationships is so critical to all of it.
Your team since 2000 have averaged almost 24 wins per season. And I'm just a little bit curious about this. What kind of goes into the preparation before seasons, like in preseason, like with lifting or running? Like, how do you get your guys prepared when you guys are going to be competing into March? So how do you get you guys prepared for that?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I've learned along the way, too. And so the finished product, if I were coaching still, I would tell you that the product's still not finished, right? Because you're always learning. And as late, I'm going to start at the end and go backwards. One of the last things that I learned that I really loved, I read a little small pamphlet. It must have only been about 25 pages, called A Coach Like Pop. I'm talking about Popovich, of course. Mm-hmm. And I used to get really frustrated. I'd peek in and watch them play our kids watch their preseason games. We couldn't start the season till November 1st. That's another NESCAC rule. Right now they've changed it, but it was November 1st, and so we were 2 weeks behind everybody, right? And so I'd get frustrated watching them because, you know, they weren't running hard enough. They weren't doing this. They weren't doing that. They weren't boxing out. They got lazy, this and that. And what Pop did was he would take those games and he would put values on certain things. So in other words, one night you'd get 1 point for every basket, okay? But you get 2 points if you got a basket off a backdoor pass. Guess what kids do?
They run outdoors,
right? And then guess what the defense does?
They adjust. They start to defend,
right? Rebounding. Kids aren't rebounding. Everybody's shooting and running back down the other way, right? Well, you give them 2 points for if they score a basket off an offensive rebound. So now all of a sudden you get kids offensive rebounding. Defense gets upset with that. Guess what they do? They box out, right? You want a fast break. You give 3 points for a fast break basket. Only one for a regular basket, right? All right. All of a sudden, you start getting fast breaks. Everybody's pushing the ball now. What does the defense do? Well, they're going to have to adjust and make sure they transition back. But you might still be given 2 points for an offensive rebound. How do you offensive rebound and transition back? So now you're giving the kids challenge. Everybody, nobody wants to sit out. We usually had three good teams. And so nobody really, everybody wanted to stay on as a winner. And so people make those adjustments. So that was one of the things that really helped us, I thought, in my later years, energize the kids in the fall. We were fortunate enough that in the second half of my career, we had a strength and conditioning coach, right? And he took care of that stuff. Like I didn't really want to know about that, right? It was great. I wanted to know if they were doing it. I wanted to know, see if they were getting better. And our guys worked really hard at it. And I'll tell you a quick story. I went down and all the guys were lifting one day, and I went down in, and Willie Workman, who's still playing in Spain after 11 years, I mean, Israel after 11 years, was a really good player for his national championship team of 2013. He was a captain on that team, a really good player. And I go down to the weight room and all the guys are standing around, and there's a few football guys around and stuff. And Willie's got, 135, 145 on the bench, and he's struggling with it, right? He gets off the bench. I said, Willie, are you kidding me? He goes, yeah, coach. He said, well, he said, wait till you see, let's see you do it, right? You can't. Let's see what you can do, right? So I sat down. Of course, now the whole weight room's all gathered around, right? I popped off like eight. Boom, 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 eight. And I got up, walked out, couldn't bend my arms for like a week, right? For a week, but I got it done. To this day, Willie will tell you that story. So we always had a lot of fun trying to get the kids to, again, my strength and conditioning coach did most of it to get our kids stronger. Coaching wise, at the end of the year, we would watch film, evaluate, things that we could do better, things that we wanted to change, things that we had to adjust with the changing of the talent, and talk to players before they went home. And then over the summer, we'd try and, break down some more stuff and, have a game plan come September and start to give it to the kids in bits and pieces so they could understand and recognize some of the stuff. Since we were going to be 2 weeks behind, we had to get it done in a hurry.
Yeah.
And we're off and running.
Yeah. This is going to be the last topic before we head to break. But obviously you coach for 42 seasons. You make 20 NCAA tournament appearances, two national championships. What do you think, like, felt like a success year to year? Or if you didn't win the national championship, was it a bust season? Talk to me about how you gauged success throughout your career.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you a couple different answers here. First of all, I think that, you know, every year is different and not every team is good enough, quite frankly, talented enough to win a national championship. And so you sort of set goals as to what I always said, you've got to win a game. And we accomplish that every year, thank God. But then I'd say, okay, now we're gonna win 10 games because now we're in double figures. These are just little games I'd play in my head. And then you have to win 13 games so you can be above 500 and then blah, 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 all the way up. And the 20-win season was a mark that you'd had a good year. And even then, you know, you never feel when you lose your last game that you couldn't have won that and moved on a little bit further. And so, you know, it's hard. It's hard to set those things. But I was in a lecture once at a leadership conference, and somebody said to me, said, "Coach, you know, we've won a lot of games. We could sit here and ask you about all the great wins, but tell us about the losses that have stuck with you." And I've had a couple losses that, you know, wake me up still at night. Not often, thank God. But I honestly, this was the answer I gave him, and it's an honest answer. I said, look, the losses that I have felt that were the toughest losses in my program were not, had nothing to do with winning basketball games. It had to do with reaching kids. And I can count them on one hand probably, and maybe even less than that. But there are two or three things that really, there were losses for me because I didn't reach. When a kid graduated from my program and still sort of didn't get it, in my opinion, it's Division III basketball. Yeah, we want to win basketball games and stuff, but you really want to get them ready for the next piece of their life. And, you know, they got another 40 years to work, 45 years to work and to have family and to be successful in that part of their life. And so, I always thought we played a role in getting kids ready for that. We tested their mettle. We threw things up in front of them that they had to solve. They had to learn to rely on each other. They had to learn to take a back seat to the other kid and yet still try to beat him out. There are so many things that athletics teaches. And I probably had three kids that I felt really badly. Those are my losses. You know, they really were. And I, that's sort of a two-prong answer to that, but the second one is more important to me than the first one.
Yeah, I respect that a lot. A lot of coaches, their drive is the wins and losses, but you saying like my players determine my wins and losses, how they are after my coaching them taught me the success. I feel like that's something that coaches don't value, but like you said, it's like probably the most important thing. So I respect that. But stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, come back, talk about you being the first coach entering the Hall of Fame. All right, we're back. Through talking to different Division III figures or just coaches around Division III, it's been rumored that you had opportunities to maybe coach at Division I high major schools or get an MBA job. So I was wondering if you could kind of confirm or deny these rumors, and if you're confirming it, just give a little insight behind what these offers might have been.
Yeah, so, you know, there were no real high level D1s. Like, I don't think that you get there anymore. I think the highest level D1 was a long time ago. University of Massachusetts Amherst made the decision to hire John Calipari. They asked me to apply. I was one of the candidates. They chose the right guy. But back then, I got to tell you something, guys, and this is the way basketball has changed. Back then, I was making what the UMass head coach was making. Mm. I think my first year I was making more than Cal was making. Not by much, but crazy stuff now. And now they're talking millions. And but Ivies, there were a bunch of Ivies that came around, at least four that we had moments with, some Patriots that came around. But once basketball started to change, I never had like a Maryland or you know, USC or, you know, I didn't have any of those big guys. And then I think later in my career, probably the last 12, it might have even affected me before that 15 years, people sort of realized that, you know, after 30 years, I wasn't moving. That I'd fallen in love with a place and that you know, I just had turned down, you know, and a lot of them have firms now, search firms, and the search firms get a little tired too. I mean, they think like, Dave, if you're not interested, just tell us you're not interested. Don't put us through this, because I got interviews. And so, and there was a time when I actually went down the pathway of thinking I might be an athletic director. I was an athletic director for 2 years at Amherst in interim things, and got some offers along that line too. And just, again, going back to the earlier thing that we had about why Amherst was so special, I had just really fallen in love with a place that I felt did it right, at a level that I felt was doing it right. And the relationships that I'd built were just so special that it was going to take a lot to move me.
So it's actually, this is actually an interesting thought. Coach Reg actually brought this up, how like there's not many coaches nowadays that you see will stay at a program or a school for maybe even 5+ years, right? Like guys are just like, some coaches just want to move to the next program or move up a level or go to a different one. So definitely got to commend you, you know, staying at the Division III level. And it's a perfect transition for me, because you actually said in your Hall of Fame enrichment speech, just give a little background, you were inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. You gotta mention that it's the Basketball Hall of Fame. You actually talked about this in a podcast, is how it's not the NBA Hall of Fame, it's the Basketball Hall of Fame. But you were inducted in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame in 2023, which was a legendary class, had Becky Hammon, Dirk Nowitzki, Dwayne Wade, just to name a few guys and coaches. And you mentioned in your Hall of Fame enrichment speech that you are proud to represent Division III. What about Division III was so special to you at the end of the day?
You know, some of the stuff we talked about why NBA teams like to hire Division III guys is that, you know, it's a no-nonsense level. You know, there's, you don't get anything. You know, we had to buy our own sneakers. Our kids had to buy their own sneakers, right? They hated the fact that we told them they all had to buy Nikes with purple swooshes on them. But they, you know, everybody had to buy their own sneakers. You know, you go on the road, you might get $12. If you're lucky, back in the day, we got $5, you know. And so you just don't have all the frills and stuff. There's, you play because you love the game, period. Mm. Now, I'm not saying that the greatest players in the country and all these Division I guys or Division I wannabes or whatever it is, don't love the game, because I'm sure they all love the game. But there's a certain type of love that you get when all you get back is the game. You know, you don't get back anything else. You don't get any remuneration. There's no guarantee you could ever play overseas. That was a long shot when we first started. And it's still pretty much of a long shot. But there's just nothing that comes back at you except the love of the game and the relationships. And so it's pure. It's, and I know it's not 100% pure, but and NIL will change that a little bit, even at the Division III level. But, you know, when I was going through, it was as pure as it could be. Nobody was buying players. Guys had, I couldn't even get a kid in if he had, you know, the wrong verbal or the wrong mathematical score. And so for me, there was no way. I couldn't turn around and have an alum step forward and say, look, we're going to give the school $100,000 if they take Joe, even though he's got a sub, you know, average SAT. Couldn't do it. And so there was never any money exchanging hands. There was never a lot of golden handshakes. Our alumni supported things that we did, but it wasn't until, I want to say it was 7 years to the end of my career, that we took 2 overseas trips in my last 7 years. We didn't even do that before. But it, again, you know, talk about the old barnstorming days when you had nothing, but it was for the love of the game. It really, Division III is special. And I'm not taking anything away from the Division I experience. If you're a one and done and you're that good and you're there for a year, I don't know. I guess you might have a great relationship with the coach and have it for the rest of your life, maybe. But it's different than playing 4 years for somebody and staying invested in that program, because there was no money there. It was just for the love of the game. And so that's what I love that about Division III.
You are actually the first ever Division III coach to ever be inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. And like I said, you mentioned in a podcast that you feel like the Naismith like committee, they want to move away from like people thinking it's the NBA Hall of Fame and want to open it more up to like it's the Basketball Hall of Fame. Like it's people from overseas, from Division III, from Division I. Like it doesn't matter where you're from. So how does it feel to break through barriers and show people in the Division III world that it's possible to reach these great heights from the small college division?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing. I don't know if I really have the word for it. My wife and I always laugh because people use surreal so much. It's sort of like it's a banned word in our household. You know, but all I can say is that there's this great feeling of pride and naturally humility too, but of pride that you have done something really special. I always tell people it's about being in the right place at the right time with the right resume. And it's those three things, because the right time, the Naismith decided they were getting criticized a bit for just being an NBA place. And so I think they decided, hey, let's look around and see if we have somebody that's of the quality that we need. And the right resume is that, you know, there was a guy on a women's coach on the nomination list this year with 900 plus wins, the winningest coach in the women's game, but he's got no championships. He's got no Final Four appearances. How is that going to mesh out? What's the resume have to look like? Do you have to have a championship? You know, do you have to have, we went to the Final Four 7 out of 11 years, which was really outstanding. And I think all of those things, so right resume, right time, right resume, it just, but as far as the feeling of it, it's hard to put into words. It's, I try to imagine this, like I grew up in Boston, or right around Boston, and was a great Boston Celtics fan. They played against the 76ers with Chamberlain and Jackson and Hal Greer and, you know, Melchione. You guys don't know those names, but they were unbelievable battles. Russell against Chamberlain, like nothing better, right? That was Bird and Magic, and then Bird comes along, Magic, all these people. Imagine being in the same Hall of Fame with them. I mean, that's like, just think of that yourself and think of the feeling that it gives you. And let me know if you come up with a word, because as I do these podcasts, it would be great to have a word. But I don't think there really is a word. It's just a feeling that's hard to describe. When I look around and see my heroes, and I said that in my speech too, like I was walking amongst my heroes. And that's, I don't know if you could put a word to that.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable feeling.
Unbelievable.
So, Coach, I actually do something in my phone every day where I take a vocab word, just a random word, and I write it in a note sheet. So I think I'm going to find a word to describe that feeling. I'm going to send it to you later on.
Well, I've done that a few times. I've looked up synonyms and all this other stuff, and I just haven't come across with something that seemed to fit the feeling that I get of having had this happen to me. And, you know, again, right place, right time, right resume. And there I was. You know, if I was still coaching and the NBA decided they wanted to do this, it would have been maybe another Division III. I don't know who, but one of those guys. I mean, the two guys that are closest to me in wins don't have championships. And do they require that? I don't know. I don't know what the committee requires of it. The committee selection, you know, you get nominated. That's the easy part. But then you have to get 7 out of 9 votes to move into the finals. And then you have to get 18 out of 24. And so I don't know how you get there, but must have been something good. And I can just tell you that somebody did say to me that when they were going through the names of the coaches in the first committee, we have to get 7 out of 9. Somebody stopped them and said, hey, have you looked at this resume? So there you go.
Yeah,
truly a legend. I mean, that's just an understatement. You're amongst the greats. So I respect you. But I want to talk about a few coaches that you just mentioned. But first, I want to mention something that was pretty interesting. You said at a D1, like you could still have a good relationship being a one and done, but it's not the same. But I think what's interesting about you and Coach Calipari that you guys might share is I watched his documentary, and every player that was listed that might be in the NBA, they always talk about how the best thing about Coach Calipari was the relationships he built with them. Like, it wasn't about them being the best basketball player. It was more about how are you going to be the best person in the future. So I feel like it's just harping on the need for building relationships instead of just focusing on basketball.
Right. And I will tell you this, that, you know, I know a lot, I've rubbed elbows with a lot of the really good coaches and top coaches out there. And John Calipari stands at the top. You know, there are a lot of people that might turn around and say, well, you know, he's the first guy to do one and done. We don't like him because of that. Well, guess what? Then everybody started doing one and done, right? Mm. So all of a sudden it became acceptable. He's always been ahead of the curve. But more than anything, I don't know anybody that gives his time to more people than John Calipari, and will embrace you with a relationship too, sort of thing. And he is really special that way. And I see some of his Facebook stuff, and then when all the Kentucky hating and all this other stuff was going on, you know, he's spending his time. All of a sudden he's with this guy, Jimmy Arnold, who was the class of something for a Kentucky basketball great, who's going through some health issues. And he's there, he's got his arm around him. He's buying some stuff for this family because they can't afford it. He's bringing them to the games. I've never seen anybody do any more for people in general than John Calipari.
That's very powerful. And I want to keep talking about Coach Calipari. So you were inducted into Hall of Fame, and each person getting inducted has one to three people that kind of induct them into the Hall of Fame. The two people that inducted you were Coach Calipari and Jim Calhoun. I don't think I have to describe much about them. Two of the greatest coaches to ever live in all sports, basically. So just talk about how you, because you mentioned in your Hall of Fame speech that those were your friends and mentors. So talk about how you developed a relationship with them. Was the relationship just basketball and trying to help each other out as coaches, or did it extend beyond basketball? And then also, how did it feel just to have them be able to induct you into a Hall of Fame?
Well, it was great. And I was delighted that and both guys didn't hesitate one second before they said 100% absolutely, I want to do this. And I'll start with Calhoun, because that's the one that happened first. Was so Jim Calhoun started as a high school coach at Dedham High School. Again, the pathway to greatness in coaching was different back then. And so many people, you read when you read Pipeline to the Pros, that some of these people started it in high school, right? The Van Gundy's sort of thing. And so anyway, the Calhoun was the high school coach at Dedham High School. He went to Northeastern. When he went to Northeastern, I got to know him quite well. I'd worked a couple camps with him. I'd go in and watch his Northeastern team play, and they were really good. They had this kid, Perry Moss, who was outstanding. And and they went to the NCAAs and on and on. They had Reggie Lewis. And so the whole, he did a great job there. And then he got the UConn job. And, you know, the UConn job wasn't a great job at the time, and he built that too. So we just have always stayed in touch. I'll never forget, I was at the Final Four. I want to say it might have been out in Denver or something. But he's walking by himself on the one day he is off. And he's not smothered with people. I see him walking by himself with a newspaper under his arm along some trolley tracks or something and down a back street. So I ran up to him and I said, hey, coach, I said, I won't take any of your time. Just wanted to congratulate you on what a great season you're having. And he said, no, no. He said, walk with me. He said, this is what I need. He said, I need to talk, you know, to the other guys, to the guys that aren't, you know, after me for this and after me for that, but want to talk to me because they're my friend. Mm-hmm. And that was just a wonderful experience that I had with him. And then, you know, Calipari, people were surprised I could get them both on the same stage, by the way. And Calipari was different. Like, I didn't know Cal until he came to UMass. And, you know, he reached out to me. He was a young gunslinger. I mean, you know, he was coming in and changing the rules of what they were doing. They weren't going to do things the way that UMass did it before. And, you know, he and the AD were in it all the time. And Cal just would sign for things. He just did what he had to do to build that program to where it should be. He was really tough on his players. I'd go over and watch practices. But, you know, he and his assistants have always been incredibly welcoming to me, to my dad when I brought him over there. And, you know, they just did this new documentary on him. I don't know if it's the one and done had been done before, but they just did a new one up here in Amherst called Refuse to Lose. And all the guys came back and they were in that. And so we'll see how that comes out. But since then, we just stayed in touch. And he's been everywhere. You know, when he was down with the Nets, again, I was on one of those winter trips where I was taking my kids somewhere in vans. And I called him and said, hey, you know, we need a place to practice in Jersey. Can we get into your, and he had the Nets. The only way he had worked for the Nets was if they built a new practice facility for him. And they did. It's a wonderful facility. And that's where we practiced. And that's where we had his cooks prepared our, it's the only good meal I think we had all week. But, you know, we had a Division One or pro meal that day, and it was unbelievable. And it just goes on and on and on, you know, whether he's at Kentucky, wherever he's been, Memphis, you know, we left Memphis, and yet we were down in the Memphis area playing Rhodes College. And again, another one of my trips, and I wanted a place to practice, and I wanted to go practice at Memphis, and he set that up for me. And you know, such a giving guy, an unbelievable guy. And he, again, when I asked him, he, and you saw how many people he had to represent and be on the stage for their inductions. He said, in a heartbeat, I want to be there for you. And he was one of the guys that told me when I talked to him earlier in the process, you know, Cal, this seems like such a big jump, Division III guy. And I know we did well, 42 years, blah, blah, blah. Hall of Fame, he says, both of those guys, I have films of them saying, you are a Hall of Fame. You deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, you know, and we'll do what we can to make it happen. So two wonderful guys, different pathways that I knew them, but both I consider friends and mentors.
Special, special stories and relationships you just talked about. One thing I was thinking about is those guys are legends, but I don't look at you guys like you were at Division III, they were at Division I. I look at you guys at the same tier. So it's no surprise to me that you were inducted into the Hall of Fame. But kind of to wrap things up, Ruta mentioned earlier your Hall of Fame class of 2023. It was a legendary class, arguably the best ever. In my humble opinion, I think it is the best ever, just the depth throughout. So I'm going to read who you were inducted with. You were inducted into Hall of Fame with Tony Parker, Dwayne Wade, Dirk Nowitzki, Paul Gasol, Coach Popovich, Jimmy Valvano, Becky Hammon. So just literally GOATs. And I want to hear from you how it felt, you know, like sharing such a special moment, being inducted to Hall of Fame with a bunch of other greats, not only alongside of you, but also in the building. Players like Allen Iverson, Tim Duncan were also there presenting. So just talk to me about, you know, that night and the feeling of sharing the moment with them.
Yeah, and you know, so we started down in Houston when they announced us, and then we, you know, we moved on to down in Connecticut where they did the presenting of the ring and jacket, and then, you know, the formal thing in Springfield the night of. But absolutely amazing, and one person spread to the other person. Guys like Mike Wilbon and guys like that I wanted to talk to that I never thought I'd get a chance to talk to, you know, from PPI. And you know, it just kept expanding the group. I had a particular fond connection with the European guys. They're, you know, I think they're a little different, you know, than the Americans they are. And it's just, they were the easiest guys to talk to. And again, I had to, you know, have a little bit of, I don't know what you'd call it, gumption to get out there. You know, you walk into a room and you see all these guys and you got to go over and say hi. You know, and they were unbelievable to me, you know, and I immediately felt like one of them. So we're down in Houston, and I think I'm just down there for a joyride. I'm going to get introduced and the whole thing. And we have a dinner the night before. They haven't announced this yet, so it's all secret. We're all being taken by a bus and hidden in this place. And I'm talking to Cal. I'm relaxed. Like, I'm just soaking it all in. I'm having a great time talking to these guys. I got no worries in the world. So I said to Cal, I said, well, this is really cool. And he said, well, you know, you're talking tonight, right? I said, hello? Talking tonight? I was really relaxed. And all of a sudden, put my drink down, stopped drinking wine, and started saying, like, what am I talking about? Like, what? He said, we're going to introduce you, and you get to tell the story, and blah, 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 blah. And it was really fun. It was fun to listen to all those guys and their stories. And I got a chance. Alvin Hayes, you know the name Alvin Hayes, the Big E?
Yeah.
Okay. Played for Houston, right?
Yep.
Very first game ever played in a football stadium was Houston versus UCLA. it was like 1969 or seven. I think it was seven. And I had to get permission from my parents, you know, ask them, could I stay up and watch this in black and white? It was black and white TV. It was an hour late or 2 hours late because it was in Houston. Lou Alcindor back then, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mm-hmm. Some great players on both sides, but the Biggie and Houston upset them. And he was at that. And so I get a chance, and this is how I am sometimes. If I could just break the ice, I'm good. Right, you got to get the first words flowing, right? I turned around and I said, Biggie, you know, you are one of my heroes. I'm going to tell a little story about that. And I got to tell a story, as my wife will tell you, I could tell stories. So one thing led to the other. And finally, I was pretty comfortable, you know, in talking with this group of guys. And one thing led to the other. We went from there. And then we came back to Springfield. And I got a chance to really spend some time with these guys. And one of my great moments was standing in between Gasol and Dirk, and you know, they're both, I didn't realize how tall they were until I saw a picture of me standing, and you know, they're both like this, right? And so it was an unbelievable experience. And they are really, those guys are just really good, down to earth guys, you know, and huge celebrities, but boy, just great guys.
That's a great answer. I said this after the last answer, but all those guys, like, in my eyes, you're on the same tier. So definitely, I like you being humble, saying those are your heroes. But guys like us, we're definitely big fans of you as well. So definitely respect everything you've done for the game and continue to do for not just basketball, but society as a whole. That means a lot. But we're going to end this episode with a little rapid fire and starting five edition. So let us know when you're ready for rapid fire.
I'm ready. I'm as ready as I'm going to be. So first of all, I'm just going to tell you this. I don't have a great liking for these only because it's like my children. Don't ask me to rate my children, right? Put one ahead of the other. And so, but I like, nobody to this date has gotten an answer from me. Who was the better point guard, Andrew Olson or Aaron Toomer? And they're not going to, right? They're different, and they're both great. But I'm going to do my best for you guys.
All right.
Okay, so this first one is kind of asking you to do that. So
that's okay.
So two national championships, 2007, 2013, if I'm not mistaken. At the height of those teams, and shout out KJ for giving me this one. At the height of both of those teams, which one, if they played in a game, both coached by you, Which team is winning?
So, and I'm going to really do my best to answer this. And I hope we don't need too much rapid fire. I would have to say that if you put me, you know, against the wall and say, no, you got to answer it or whatever, you know, something dire, then I would probably say the 2008, 2007, 2018 would win because of their depth and their size. But they were very different teams. So that team was huge. When we played in the national championship game, Brendan Adair, who now is an NBA official, by the way, was player of the year in the country that year, 6'5 kid, and he could do everything. He was so good. And when we beat them by 20, his interview at the end of the game, he said, well, the problem was they had a 6'5 kid on me. And when I got by him, they had a 6'6 kid on me. And I got by him, there was a 6'7 kid, and then finally a 6'10 kid. And he said, I couldn't get anywhere. And so we're interchangeable pieces sort of thing. So that's what they had going for him. Great point guard, great big kid, Kevin Hopkins, four great senior leaders. But the 2013 team, and this is why I'm still a little up in the air, they just knew each other so well. They were smaller as far as not only size, but there were only really six of them and then two freshmen. So eight of them that played any minutes at all didn't have the depth, didn't have the size. But John Feinstein, who I love the way he writes about sport, and I'd never met him personally, came up to me at the end of the game and introduced himself. And I was so humbled to talk to him. And he goes, can I talk to you about your team? And I said, yeah, I'd love to talk about my team. He goes, I watched your team come down. And they hold up number one, and four different times you ran four different things. What's going on out there? I said, because they're reading each other. And that group of guys, even more so than the 2007 team, read each other. I mean, it was unbelievable. They played off each other like nothing. And it was, it's like, because there weren't that many subs, they played so many years together, they just, you know, without talking, it was that invisible language that, and people did great things because of it. And you had a guy like Aaron running it. You had a great athlete like Alan Williamson in there. So you had all these terrific players, but a smaller number of them. So it was unbelievable how they played together. And so they were different. If you really force me to answer, I'm going to take that other team for the reasons I gave you. But I got to tell you, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a closer game than a lot of people think. And you might even have an upset there.
Okay, I like that. Next rapid fire question. So obviously, Amherst, you know, you guys have the little three, which is the rivalry between Williams and Wesleyan, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm just curious, were there any other teams in the NESCAC besides those two other programs that you always either looked forward to playing slash like you always like when you did beat them, you're like, we got them. I was happy about that.
Yeah, you know, so for a long time, Wesleyan wasn't good. Okay. And, mm-hmm. and they had a great coach, Herb Kenny, who I really respected and loved. And he was one of my mentors. And so that was a special relationship. And of course, Williams, you always wanted to beat Williams. And I'm happy to say that the last 21 times we played them, we beat them 17 of the 21, which I'm mm-hmm. not going to hide that. But I would tell you there's two teams that I enjoyed playing against more as far as great competition goes, and that was Middlebury and Tufts. And Middlebury, you know, there was just an edge, and they were not good. They were not good, and all of a sudden, with about 12 years left to go in my career, they became great. And Rush Riley, who was a coach at Middlebury for a long time, left his AD position to join with Jeff Brown, who was the Middlebury coach, and together they built an unbelievable team, and they were competitive every single year. They went to a Final Four once, but they were always in like the eight. They were always good. And we had a triple overtime up there where Willie Workman had to knock one off the front rim. I don't know if you've seen this, but so we're down three, and they foul Willie with 3.2 to go. So Willie makes the first one because they fouled him when he wasn't shooting a three. And smart team, well coached. And he banged it off the front rim, got his own rebound later. Then game goes into overtime. Aaron Toomey, who hadn't hit a shot most of the game, had a rough game, hits a three in the third overtime to solidify the win. But we had games like that all the time with them. And then Tufts is a little bit different because Tufts was always quirky. Tufts always had a ton of talent. They were always really competitive. They had an edge with us. And, you know, matter of fact, my last sort of memory of playing Tufts was that it was the Elite Eight game at their place. And the night before, they had oversold the place. My parents were both like in around 90. And they had driven down to see the game, and they just said, we can't come back. We're going to watch it at home because it's dangerous. Mm. The place was overpacked. Kids, a little bit of alcohol here and there too. The kids in the aisles, kids hanging on each other, going crazy. And, you know, again, for some unknown reason, it's a tie game. The next night was 3 minutes to go, and we go on a 13-0 run to end the game. And but we had games like that all the time with them. And so Tufts and Middlebury, excitement-wise, competitiveness-wise, we're right up there with Williams. Trinity was always good. But there was something special. There was an edge with us, with Tufts and Middlebury, that there wasn't even that edge, you know, with Williams. So we wanted to win the Williams game because it was our biggest rival.
Yeah.
But it was an edge with the other ones that took it a level above. And you know how that stuff goes, right?
Mm-hmm. 100%. For sure. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure Coach Toomey, I think I asked him a similar question in the rapid fire, and I'm pretty sure he said Tufts too. So it's kind of funny how you guys are on the same page with that.
He said because they always thought they were better than everyone.
Well, I wasn't going to go into that.
But yeah, no. Different reasons.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. They had talent. I'll tell you, they had some unbelievable talent. And I have to tell you that twice I thought they had national championship teams. The team that we beat in the Elite Eight, I thought was a national championship team, okay? And so they're playing us the year that we won the national championship, and Olsen hit what's called the shot in Amherst basketball lore. And again, they're up three, and they don't foul us. And Andrew's not the only guy on the ball. Matt Goldsmith held it for a minute. I would have fouled him in a heartbeat. And they didn't foul. And now it's too late. Andrew leans in, shoots a three, goes in. We win in overtime. Mm. And I thought that was a national championship team they have. And as I told Andrew, about a month later, I'm in my gym, and I see these two little kids shooting around. And one of the kids goes, "Watch, I'm going to do an Andrew Olsen." Mm. And he leans in and chucks it from the three-point line. I said, "Andrew, when you see that, you know you've made it. When kids are indicating and calling it an Andrew Olsen." But if you want to watch that, it's incredibly exciting. If you go to the Amherst archives, the shot is an unbelievable you only watch last 40 seconds probably, but it's wonderful. And so that's how we beat, I thought Tufts had two national championship teams.
I like that. I like that a lot. So last rapid fire question. So I was listening to a podcast recently with Sean McVay, who's the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams in the NFL. And he was talking about how basically, like, obviously, yeah, when they won the Super Bowl, like, you look back at those teams in that year with a lot of great memory and appreciation for the guys. But recently in 2023, they had a pretty good season. They didn't go far in the playoffs, but a lot of people doubted them heading into the season because they had a bad year in 2022. And he looks back, and Sean McVay says that he looks back at the 2023 team with a lot of great memories and even a little bit more appreciation for that team because they made him fall in love with the game again. So I'm just curious if there was a team outside of the two national championship teams that you look back on, you're like, "Damn, we didn't win the national championship this year, or maybe we didn't win many games, but you know, that group, that was a special one, and I'll always appreciate them." So I was wondering if you could name that team.
Yeah, you know, again, I had 42 of them, and take national championships, and I got 40 left to choose from.
True. But, true.
You know, I would have to say that my really early years, my first team, is one of those teams because they were patient with me. Mm. I mean, think about that. I'm 24 years old. When I was a senior, I rushed my captain, who became my first captain, into my fraternity. I don't know if you guys belong to fraternities and what it takes to rush people in, but you know, it's this whole recruiting process, and it's outside the bounds of really what you want your kids almost to do, right? And it's like, but that team was so special. And I look back, there's a video that Josh Estes, who's with Cleveland, did for me on my retirement. We didn't know all this other stuff was going to happen. He did this great video for me to a great Whitney Houston song, which gives me chills when I watch it. But it's that first team. It's that very first Williams game. And we're in this old cinder block locker room with chalk. You don't know what chalk is probably either anymore, but chalk. We had chalk, but we wrote on chalkboards, right? And I gave some, you know, "Hey, let's go get them," sort of thing. And the guys ran out. And that game is there. And that special moment sort of, as Sean McVay said, sort of captivated me to the game. Like when I coached that season and that game in particular, we won our first Williams game, which is a big to-do. And the place was packed. Like, again, I should send you guys some of these things because you'd really enjoy seeing them. The place, there wasn't a seat available. There wasn't anything left there for, I mean, that's the way it used to be. And that team made things really, and I think back to the characters that were on that team, and they show pictures of a couple of them up close where they're sweating, the fight of the game. So it just gave me more love than I had. And more love to believe that I could coach and that I wanted to coach. And this is what I wanted to do. And Amherst was a place I wanted to do it. So I think the first one was really special. And there's a bunch of special ones along the way, naturally. Teams that couldn't go any further than the ECACs. And we won three ECAC championships. And that first one that we had, again, packed house, unbelievable. And it's all we could do. And that was so special. And those guys to this day, I'm going to the wedding of one of the children of one of the captains of that team. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of special teams, a lot of special relationships. But if you had me choose one again, I'd go back and say that first one was so meaningful to me.
You mentioned this video. Is it the video that all your players like said a few words
So that's the second half of it. So the first half is the video, yeah, and then they have those things at the end. Have you seen all that?
No, I haven't seen it. I just I think I read it or heard you talk about it on something I was looking at. So I have a quick question, kind of rapid fire, but was there any specific moment in that video through your players that you're like, that's something I want to remember for the rest of my life?
I got to tell you, it's the whole video. I mean, it starts out with this Williams game and we're coming out and it's 1977. How long ago is that, right? And I'm this young guy. I mean, I'm really young. Maybe I look like I should be playing it, maybe not even playing yet. And then they bring up special games. They bring up Andrew. They show Andrew Olsen's shot. They show some national championship footage. And they just show sort of clips of when we won our last NESCAC championship out at Hamilton. And when we won the game at Tufts, the game I was just telling you about, the Elite Eight game. All those things are sort of snapshotted in there. And again, it's a Whitney Houston song, and you know she's one of my faves. And nobody's done a national anthem or will ever do a national anthem like Whitney Houston did. I'm telling you that right now.
Yes, sir.
And the song itself, like I really can't watch it without getting tears in my eyes, and it's all really special.
Yeah. Before we get into starting five, quick shout out to Ma Duke. She'll like that you're a Whitney Houston fan. She's one of Whitney's biggest fans as well. So you guys got a little connection there. Yeah. But moving on, so we're going to head to the starting five edition. If you're a coach assembling a starting five, who is your lineup going to be? And this edition is going to be the best players you've coached throughout your 42 years at Amherst.
Right. And so just outside of that 42, when I was an assistant, I wasn't his head coach. Jimmy Rehnquist is the best, but so I'm going to push him aside. But he was a player that could have played a lot of places. Anyway, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put Toomey and Olsen in the backcourt. Okay, surprise, surprise. Right? Andrew was really interesting because Andrew just loved to be on the ball and didn't care if he ever scored a point. Assists were his baby. Toomey was both, but Toomey was a scoring point guard. You know, he put up some numbers and loved to shoot the ball too. So you got those two, I think, complement each other really well in the backcourt. I don't know who is going to have the ball at the end of the game in a really close, tough game. Though I tell you what, there might be a fist fight out there for that. There's a kid, Jamal Wilson. I'm going to put him at the three. Jamal was a 6'3" kid, and we got Jamal away from a Division I scholarship, actually, at Furman. And he was from Florida, played for Tampa Prep, and Jamal could play. He was so raw as a my dad, again, quick story, and I don't want to take long. My dad was checking out Florida to retire to, and I said, hey, can you go over and see this kid play for me? And it wasn't Jamal. It was another kid. So he goes to see. He calls me up. He said, hey, Dave, that kid that you had sent me to see, he's not going to make you better. He said, check out this other kid, Jamal Wilson. Jamal was junior. So we got in touch with him. Never thought we'd get him, and we got him. And a little bit raw, didn't play a lot as a freshman. And you talk about teaching kids things. I'll never forget, you know, he's talking to me as a sophomore. He's saying, coach, I can help the team. And I said, Jamal, you got to play with the team. That's all. I'm just telling you, you got to do this, this, and this. This is what you got to do better. You know, you got to buy in, right? And all of a sudden, one game, I feel a little nudge next to me on the bench. It's Jamal. He's sitting next to me. He goes, coach, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm in. Just like that, right? Like, and I said, for real? He goes, for real. So I put him in the game. The coaches that were scouting that game, I'll never forget, they came to me and said, who the heck is this kid, Jamal Wilson? Jamal could do everything. Jamal had 9 threes and 4 dunks in one game.
Mm.
Division III player.
Mm.
He flat out play. And crazy guy. I mean, he had more enthusiasm and athleticism. And one of the first guys that was the only guy I've ever had that played in the old, it's not the D League, the G League. It was the thing before that. It was, you know, that long ago. He was like a 93 guy. He would have been a 96 guy. And the coach called me up from that league and he said to me, coach, you got any more kids like Jamal? I said, what do you mean? And he goes, I'm not talking about his talent. He said, I'm talking about a kid that's got that much talent but also has such respect for the game and respect for his teammates and all the things I wanted to hear. And I called Jamal and told him, I said, hey, thank you. Thank you for espousing all those things and all that. And you know,
that's the success you were talking about, the determined success versus not a success. He got it.
Yeah, and he got it. And, you know, here I got the next level to pro guy calling me up, you know, telling me I want a kid with these characteristics again. So it was a great thing. So Jamal, that's my three man. You know, I got a bunch of great players, as you can imagine, but you know, I'm going to take a stab at 4 and 5, and everybody that watches this is going to get ticked off with me. But we had a kid, Fletcher Walters, and Fletcher came to me at 6'5" out of Michigan, and he graduated at 6'8", but he came in and he was a guard and he stayed a guard, but I'm going to put him at the four. And he could do everything. I'll never forget, we were playing Salve Regina one night, and you know, they weren't great, and they're sitting and everybody's doing stuff, but Fletcher's out warming up. So the coach came up to me and Sean, and Sean goes, hey, my kids are telling about, who the heck is this kid? And I said, oh, that's Fletcher Walters, but he probably won't play tonight. He's down the list a bit. And he looks at me like, because the kid's dunking, shooting threes, left-hander, right? By the time he graduated, when he went over and played, and he played pro for 2 years overseas, he was beyond belief. I thought he might have been a G League player. He was that good. He could do everything. At 6'8", long, lefty. Lefties are hard to play. He could do everything. And so he wouldn't have been on that list his first 2 years, but the way he finished up, I'm going to tick everybody off and put him on that list. And then as a big kid, so I'm trying to do not just five shooters or scorers or something like that. I'm trying to put people in positions. I had a couple really good big kids, but Kevin Hopkins, and Kevin's the head coach now. Muhlenberg, doing a great job. Great coach. He's 6'10". And when we get him again, you know, we get him, and I think he's sort of too good for us. And he was playing behind a kid, playing behind a kid, playing behind a kid. And then he should have been and was basically starting, but I was starting a senior captain in front of him for different reasons, coaching reasons. But anyway, Kevin was great with it. And he played overseas too. He's 6'10", can do everything, could run the floor like a deer, dunk everything. He and Olsen had a special connection, and Olsen would just, you know, Kevin knew where the ball was coming, and he caught more alley-oops than any kid we've ever had. But I had a kid later on, Joe Schneider, who was a wonderful player. I had another kid, Pat Fitzsimmons from North Carolina, who was a great athlete that could have started at center. But I'm going to give the nod to Kevin.
I respect it. That's a great lineup. And I heard is that your wife in the background?
It was.
Can we get a little can she make an appearance on Not Even D2 real quick?
Yeah, she can come over here. Yeah, absolutely.
You said she was getting inducted into the Hall of Fame as well soon. The diving.
Hello.
Mrs. Hickson.
She was inducted last September.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So congrats. Just congrats. Two goats sitting next to each other. I respect you guys and appreciate the relationship that you guys built for the Hickson family for sure.
Well, but, she did a lot of it. I'll tell you what, tugging the kids around, we'd hand the kids off, and they were either in a gym or in a pool. So,
I heard you say in your Hall of Fame speech too that two winter coaches that don't believe in daycare. What was that about?
Well, so our oldest son Matthew, the guy who's in film, he did daycare for half a year, maybe 3/4 a year or something like that. And you know, we walked in to pick him up one day, and you know, nobody was doing anything. Everybody was on their phone or, you know, doing something. You know, the people that should have been helping weren't occupying the kids and stuff. And we thought, like, what the hell with this? Paying this money to, you know, send a kid to that when we can hand them off to students. Imagine, and the students love to take care of kids. And I'll tell you what, our oldest son had a vocabulary that you couldn't believe by the time he was four. He was hanging out with all of her divers and, you know, hanging out a bit with my basketball players too, but they weren't using all those. All the divers and the swimmers were pre-med, and they were all girls. And so they were coddling him and, you know, teaching him all these words. And he was just like, it was amazing the things that he would say and do at an early age because of that. And so we thought that was a great thing. And then, you know, I don't know if you have siblings, but if you're the second, you know, you want to do everything the first is doing. And so the second one, he said, I'm not going to daycare. He's not going, I'm not going, you know, so, and that's the way he is.
I'm not going to school either. Yeah, and
I'm
not going to
school. I'm just going to dive and play sport. And so it was a wonderful, you know, whatever. Our oldest son's actually home today, came up for 4th of July with us. But, you know, it goes by so quick when you have kids. Don't miss a minute of it because it goes by so quick.
Yeah. Truly a legendary family. A huge shout out to you guys. But that's going to do it for another episode of Not Even D2. Ruta mentioned this in a text message, but we're truly honored and definitely grateful that you took your time out of your day to record with us, big time by you, and looking forward to learning more about your organization you're helping in Florida. So definitely keep us in the loop with that and keep up the good work.
I'll do that. And listen, you know, if you're ever out and about and if I can help you connect with somebody, I'm not 100%. As Ben Kaplan will tell you, there are a couple guys you can't get by the firewall, you know?
Yeah.
You know, Tommy Thibodeau and I are friends forever, but we couldn't get to him.
Yeah.
And when I would ask him, he couldn't answer me because they have rules. And, but if I can help you get anybody on the show or if I can help you connect with anybody, you know, don't hesitate to ask me and I'll do the best I can do with it.
Appreciate you, Coach, big time. This has been a great episode. You know, KJ and I, we were, like he said already, we said throughout the pod, we were happy to have you. And now just as a, both, you know, joining the podcast as a guest, but also just as a connection now, more than grateful to have that. So
great.
Appreciate it. And enjoy the golf days. Enjoy that this nice weather that we're having. Appreciate you, Coach.
Absolutely. And don't forget, read.
Pipeline to the Pros.
Pipeline to the Pros, because you'll see how many Division III guys have made a huge impact on the game that we see today.
So. Will do. Have a good one, Coach.
All right, guys. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Not Even D2. If you haven't already, make sure to go follow all the socials at Not Even D2. You can catch every episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, KJ Allison, and I'll see you next episode.